are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, November 28th, 2016. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Monday, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, author, activist, host, Bill Fletcher Jr., what are the left's next moves, and Fidel Castro's complicated legacy, particularly with regard to the African and African-American communities. Donald Trump, it does really bug him that he lost the popular vote. And when things bug him, what does he do? He goes on Twitter and he makes stuff up, because frankly, it's a tremendous move. Nikki Haley, Betsy DeVos, added to the Trump cabinet, his very own small-scale cabinet of deplorables. Is Mitt Romney going to be Secretary of State, or is this more like a long, drawn-out public humiliation exercise as revenge for Mitt Romney's comments about Donald Trump during the presidential election? Ethics lawyers say that for Bush and Obama, say that Trump needs to divest from all of his business interests by the time the Electoral College votes in December, and Trump doesn't get it, to say the least. Brazil, rocked by a major corruption scandal, hitting the successor of Dilma Rousseff, the one who helped engineer and force her out of office on incredibly questionable charges, is now engulfed in a non-questionable, deeply real scandal. Fidel Castro has died. Reactions from across the political spectrum, from total apologies, justification for everything in his complicated legacy, to Ted Cruz using it as an opportunity to weasel his way out of a question with Martha Raddatz. That and so much more, of course, the Dakota Pipeline, protests still happening. The Army Corps, I believe it was December 7th, Matt?
December 5th.
December 5th, rather, had said that they were going to clear up the camp. Already tremendous human rights abuses going on there as we speak. We'll get to that as well. I had a decent vacation. I am very much not feeling very well, unfortunately. Kicking off a cold. Hopefully I can get rid of it pretty soon. So just really briefly, there are going to be a myriad of ways of dealing with Donald Trump over what looks like the next 4 years. Mockery will continue, no question. And then we got to kind of disaggregate the different streams. We have the traditional Republican goals that are coming out of the Ryan wing and the House and the legislative agenda that's being prepared, which is to make America poorer, dumber, sicker, decimate working people, decimate the middle class, give massive handoffs to the wealthiest and the most privileged and the corporate sector. And then there is the fact that obviously Donald Trump is interested in the power of the office for his own just sort of narcissistic interests, his personal businesses. And the state being used that way is a different step, as corrupted as the process has been. There hasn't been necessarily that same kind of direct symmetry in the past, in the recent past. So I'm going to, there's this piece in Think Progress where eight lawyers for the past two presidents have basically come together to say that the Electoral College must reject Trump unless he sells his businesses. And these are top lawyers for both Bush and Obama. And I'm going to quote, this is an email of to Think Progress. This one is from Norman Eisen, who was a chief ethics counsel for Barack Obama. And they basically say that, look, let me find this quote. The notion that his or through his agent solicitation of those payments, these are payments from foreign governments, and making those payments unrelated to his office is laughable. This problem has been repeated, quote, over and over with Trump's other properties and business interests. So this is referring, of course, to everything from the sort of intimation that diplomats coming into the United States should stay at Trump hotels. There was a report that Trump personally raised a business interest he had in Argentina when he was on the phone with the Argentinian president. So this is sort of at the forefront of the kind of basic operational problems of a Trump presidency. Now, these were raised in a conversation with the New York Times that Trump had last week, where he said a number of things. Probably most importantly, he said, I won't deny that the brand is hot. Doing really well. So it's real estate. It's hard to get rid of. Anyways, more on that later. As I mentioned to you, we got to get to Bill Fletcher in just a minute. But first, I want to talk to you about today's sponsors. I have a terrible cold, and I want to get rid of it. And that's why I need to think about one of today's sponsors, and that is Soothe. Soothe.com. It's a basically in-home massage service. Kelly yanked this first Soothe spot that we got. And she's here to tell you about her Soothe experience.
I didn't steal anything.
You stole. Not good.
It was really great. A certified massage therapist comes to your home. You schedule it online. I got a notification that someone had been assigned to me. Within 5 minutes, I got a text message. And I scheduled it the same day for later on in the day. And she showed up on time and brought a massage table, which in New York is very impressive to carry around, and set everything up. And, you know, it was just as good as any a few times I've gotten very expensive, nice spa massages. And she was just as good of a massage therapist. It was great.
Look, everyone needs relaxation in their life. These are obviously very stressful times, and you need to take care of yourself during them. And a lot of stress and busyness adds up around the holidays. We all know that. Families are not necessarily super relaxing to be around. So this is a really good time to think about Soothe. It's easier than ever to relax. People will come directly, certified massage therapists, as Kelly said, will come directly to your home, work, or where you're traveling. It delivers you a massage to your door in as little as 1 hour. When it's time for your massage, a licensed therapist will arrive with all the essentials for a quality spa experience, including table, fresh linen, music, oils, and lotions. Book your massage in less than 10 seconds on the mobile app or website, www.soothe.com. And this week, my listeners can get $30 towards their first massage with Soothe. That's SOOTHE.com. When you enter at Soothe, SOOTHE, when you enter majority at checkout. Just search Soothe in the App Store or Google Play, download the app, or go to www.soothe.com and schedule your appointment today. That's soothe.com. Promo code majority for 30 off your first massage. Soothe, massage delivered to you. Links on the website. Now, it is the holidays, and are you struggling to find the perfect gift for someone who has it all? Now, we've talked about, and I did before, we've fought over these Omaha steak packages that come to the Majority Report offices. They, all of the stuff that I've had from them. The fries, burgers, a little bit of the steak. It really, if you are a carnivore, you will enjoy this stuff immensely. And it's a great gift. Omaha Steaks offers unique gifts for gourmet food lovers. A great steak experience at home. The most flavorful tender aged beef plus seafood, poultry, pork, veal, lamb, veggies, desserts, appetizers, pasta, soup, soups, seasonings, sauces, and so much more. Why over Omaha Steaks is over, sorry. Omaha Steaks has over 500 gourmet gift ideas, highest quality cut and ingredients, a one-of-a-kind flavor, convenient and quick shopping for those on your list, aged for 21 days to unlock the full flavor of the cuts, hair trimmed, vacuum sealed, online recipes, wine pairings, and so much more. That's right. You can go to their website. It's very easy to use. You can get a match for everything you need. You can lay out a proper meal. Enjoy it. Right now, Omaha Steaks is giving an exclusive savings just for Majority Report listeners. Listen to everything that you get for less than $50. This really is an insane deal. Two filet mignons, two top sirloins, two boneless pork chops, four boneless chicken breasts, four kielbasa sausages, two burgers, 12 ounce pork, all beef meatballs, four potatoes au gratin. Is that correct?
Au gratin.
Yeah. Au gratin. Four caramel apple tartlets. Oh, those are really good. I forgot about those. Omaha steak and one Omaha steak seasoning packet, plus get four additional kielbasa sausages for free. Go to omahasteaks.com. Enter my code REPORT in the search bar. Add the family gift pack to your cart and get 77% savings. It's a gift guaranteed to be a hit. And that's right. When you just go into the search bar, all you got to do is put in report in the search bar. And one more sponsor I want to let you all know about, and that is Movement Watches. This is like the perfect spectrum of holiday gifts here. You have, I know you're stressed out of your mind, to either yourself or a family member, here, let me get you a top quality massage directly to your door. Boom, done. Or how about we all just have some amazing meals at an unbelievable, insanely good price? Omaha Steaks, boom, done. And now it's time of renewing your wardrobe, looking fashionable. And that's why I want to talk about Movement Watches. We get it, holiday shopping can be tough, but thanks to Movement Watches, all of that gift-giving anxiety can disappear with the press of a button. These watches make the perfect purchase for just about anyone in your life. And remember, they start at only $95. Movement watches start at just $95. At the department store, you're normally looking at $400 to $500. That's insane. Movement figured out by selling online, they're able to cut out the middleman and retail markup, providing the best possible price. And they look incredibly good. Classic design, quality construction, and styled minimalism. Over 500,000 watches sold in over 160 countries. Get 50% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to Movement. That's MVMTwatches.com/majority. MVMTwatches.com/majority. This watch has a really clean design. I know that Sam's wife, Nikki, loves hers. He's mentioned it. It's a great gift. I'm seriously thinking about getting one. And now is the time to step up, really, frankly, all of our watch games. Go to movementwatches.com/majority. That's movementwatches.com/majority. Join the movement. We will be right back with Bill Fletcher Jr. on the Majority Report.
And easy, rock me nice and slow. I in the early morning, and you turn me on, so let the good times roll. I said them try fi separate we, but me no wanna crack fi smoke. Give me the ital in my brain and let it light up in my dome. I wonder if I'm me alone one, steam in the sense every time. the perfect tree. I love my marijuana. Rastaman, strictly herbs for me. Boy. Granny say not touch it. And he say, Grandma, you're insane. Nobody incriminate, not coach it. It never hurt nobody's brain.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Bill Fletcher Jr. He's an author, activist, and former president of the Trans Africa Forum. Bill, how are you doing?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm trying to kill a cold, to be honest with you, but in general, a lot to appreciate.
Yes, indeed.
Bill, we're going to get to a couple of different sort of longer-term things about the situation that we face today as we're sort of hurtling into this Trump presidency. The other day, it occurred to me, I was watching James Bond over the break, and I was like, his cabinet looks like Spectre, except more white. But we'll get, yeah, but we'll get to that. But you wrote a reflection on Fidel Castro. You actually had the opportunity to meet him several years ago. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you could talk about your personal experience meeting him and then sort of use that as a door to get into some of the man's fuller legacy.
So I met him in January 1999. I was on a delegation that TransAfrica led to Cuba prior to my becoming the president of the organization. Randall Robinson was the president. And we were there to look at the impact of the U.S. blockade on Cuba and on Afro-Cubans in particular. So on the final day of the trip, we were there, I don't know, 7 days, 10 days. The final day of the trip, we were told that we would have an opportunity, we might have an opportunity to meet with President Castro. And we would not know, but we had to hang out at the hotel and wait. Hmm. So at about 11:30 p.m., we received notification that he was prepared to meet with us. And so we got on a bus and went to his offices. And we went into a waiting room, and the door opened. And as I wrote in that piece that I composed about Castro, this old man came out, and I was like a little bit stunned because I still had in my mind the Castro of the 1960s. So this old man comes out in his green fatigues. And he's introduced to everybody, he's not smiling. He's friendly, but not smiling.
About how many people are in the room?
I would say there are probably all told about 30 people in the room.
Okay, got it.
And so then we were escorted into an area where we were going to meet with him. And Michael, we sat there until 3:30 in the morning.
Wow.
And he never lost any energy.
He was a bull.
He was amazing. He seemed like he was getting more energy as things were proceeding. And I had to tell Randall that we actually needed to go back to the hotel to prepare for our flights home. And that was the only reason the meeting ended when it did. what struck me about the meeting, there were many things that struck me. One was, you just love listening to him talk. Mm. I mean, the guy was so smart. But the other thing that struck me was when he talked about race and in Cuba, race and racism. And one of the things that we had encountered, and I've encountered subsequently, is some level of defensiveness by Cuban officials when people bring up issues about race and racism in the current, in Cuba as it is now. And the reality is that Cuba has made more advances in fighting racism than probably any other country in the Western Hemisphere. That said, there are ongoing issues of racism and racial discrimination that exist. It's not institutionally supported. There's no ideology that supports it, but it's there. So we had, on our delegation, we had been speaking with people about it. So we had an opportunity to ask Castro. And to my surprise, he went into this really interesting, in-depth analysis of race and racism in Cuba. And he said, when we took over in 1959, we thought all that we needed to do was to make racism and racial discrimination illegal. So we did that, and we desegregated everything, and then what we realized only later was that was not enough, and that racism was very deeply seated in Cuban culture, which was not surprising since it had been a Spanish colony and there had been slavery and then neocolonialism. And he said, and that was a big mistake on our part, to underestimate how deeply seated it was in Cuba. And this was, I thought, a very, very interesting revelation and indeed self-criticism by Cuba's leader. And you know, it's interesting about Castro, because there's different moments when Castro would come out and say, I was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
He said he was wrong about gays and lesbians.
Right.
He was wrong about religion. He would say that. And it's funny, because the way that he's being demonized in the U.S. media, I'm trying to think of U.S. presidents who were prepared to say that they were wrong.
George W. Bush all the time, man. He was very self-reflective.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
There you go.
Bill,
you know?
Be fair. Come on.
You know, what's interesting when you mention Bush, because right. Let's talk about his father for a second.
Right.
George H.W. Bush was the one who said that he wouldn't apologize even if he knew the U.S. had done something wrong.
Right.
And that's something that I never forgot either.
I didn't even know that quote. That's a heavy quote. So the other thread that's interesting, I mean, there's kind of three different pieces to me that are interesting about Castro that, you know, one is just the sort of innate reality, and it's kind of morally neutral, that this guy who ran a small island of relatively just literally geographic and geopolitically, it's small. It doesn't have that much weight to throw around. And somehow, for decades, this was a historically influential figure. That's just kind of fascinating in and of itself. Number two, and I think it's important to hold a balanced and full view of his legacy. And of course he committed some human rights abuses and things that I wouldn't like or approve of. But it was fascinating to me to notice a couple of months ago, or actually maybe at this point it's a year ago, when King Abdullah died. You know, the Times and all these other places put out these very like contextual obituaries of like, oh, you know, this was a guy who presided over the Saudi system. He did implement some kind of modest reforms, and you know, and then they would, you know, quote Dennis Ross or people like that to say like, oh, you know, he was a great reformer. Meanwhile, just by definition, overseeing the Saudi system means that you support gender apartheid, beheadings. I mean, if you're just talking on that pure human rights level,
that's
like the
right.
way we detail it by Amnesty International. So it's stunning that we can't even at this point, even after an opening, have a holistic and full view of Castro. And then the third thing that I think is very important in this moment, I know you've already touched on, but I think you can also speak to the global dimension of it. You know, this was also someone who earned an enormous amount of popularity in the Caribbean, among African Americans, and in Africa, because he was literally, and again, coming from an incredibly small power base, a fighter against colonialism and racism globally, not just in his own society. And if we're going to have a full accounting of him, Nelson Mandela making one of his first trips to Cuba after he was, you know, released from prison and apartheid was being dismantled, that has to be on the ledger too.
Each of your points, very, very important, and also quite eloquent. Let me just start with the first one. Because your reference to the Saudis is so on the money. The problem, what irritates the U.S. about Cuba is actually two things. One is that the Cuban movement, Cuban Revolution, challenged property relations.
Right.
And property relations are sacred for the United States. And touching
and the Saudis. Sorry.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So touching them is what brings the wrath of the U.S. dollar on you. And that's what we saw. It was not about how many people were executed in the beginning. I mean, the executions were targeted at mafiosi,
right.
at torturers, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what they're concerned about. They're concerned about property relations. But the other thing that irritated the hell out of the United States about Cuba, just as it did Haiti, was that here you had this country that wasn't just small, but it was brown and black. And they had basically thumbed their nose at the United States. And you just don't do that. Right? You just don't do that. The Haitians kicked out the French and have never been forgiven for that. And the Cubans dared to turn their country from being a whorehouse and casino into a country that's had a major impact on the world. And the U.S. has never forgiven them for that. And now we hear President-elect Trump and his crew discussing in very threatening ways, very threatening tones, that they will want more concessions from Cuba and changes, et cetera. But it goes fundamentally back to property and race.
And they want to bring the Batista-style governance to the United States itself. I mean, you know, I think...
That's the way it feels.
Yeah, it's absolutely the way it feels. And I think the last thing I'll say on it for me is I think it, if everybody, you know, and I'm an admitted Godfather head, but if everybody can watch Godfather 2 and watch the Cuba sequence and realize that that is a perfect distillation of, again, for all of his many imperfections, that's what Castro was overthrowing. It was a mafia state that literally on the rooftop of a hotel in Havana, these guys are slicing a cake up that symbolizes the entire Cuban economy. And it was all in concert with the U.S. government, the CIA, all of the major multinationals operating in Cuba, and the mafia. That's real. That is like one of the most politically, historically accurate sequences in film. That's what he was overthrowing.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And I think to going to your another point that you were raising. So the Cuban Revolution, in thumbing its nose at the United States, did something more than that. It wasn't just rhetorical. They provided incredible assistance to national liberation movements around the world. They provided medical assistance to countless countries. In fact, as you may remember, when we had Hurricane Katrina, they offered assistance to the United States because they have an immense amount of experience with hurricanes. And they offered to help, and the United States turned Cuba and Venezuela down. You know, after they made their respective offers, they trained doctors from all over the world. I mean, how many countries do this? And so, you know, yes, there are criticisms that absolutely can be made of the Cuban system, of the late Fidel Castro. I, for one, believe in term limits.
right.
You know, and I mean, I just do. And I actually had that discussion once with some Cubans. But it's their system, last time I checked.
Right.
And the U.S. does not have the moral standing, please, you know, it just doesn't, to make the kinds of criticisms that they're making. You know, it's just interesting. Here's a historical note. So I've been in these discussions and people talk, well, all these people left Cuba. Okay. Now, in 1783, when the U.S. became independent, there were thousands and thousands of people that left the United States.
Right.
But we don't talk about that. We act as if that was sort of irrelevant, if it happened at all. We have this complete myth about the origin of the United States. Thousands of people left. They migrated to Canada, or they migrated to the Caribbean. In some cases, went back to Britain. But they left. The fact that people left Cuba after the revolution should not have been any kind of surprise. And then when you add on to that, it's a poor country, and beginning in the 1980s, you'd have people leaving primarily for economic reasons.
Right.
But that's not different than people leaving Mexico for economic reasons.
Right. That got conflated in terms of exactly that a lot of people were leaving many economically challenging circumstances across the Latin America as well as many other places, in fact. And, you know, they were, at least in Cuba, there was good public infrastructure and health spending. So, you know, I just think it's very important, and I'm glad that we got a chance to talk about this. And it's, in a weird way, it also gets us into the conversation of the election, because one of the things that I sort of noticed on just even social media and in conversation, and I wasn't sort of, you know, hunting for, you know, there were some people I know who had some, I thought, you know, very principled criticisms of Castro and didn't remember him fondly. But I wasn't kind of looking for a certain perspective on it. But one of the things that I did notice was, one, there's a left-right, obviously, divergence. But there was a very big racial divergence in the memory of Castro, which I thought was fascinating. And I thought that was something that was good for us to get into. And in a weird, disturbing way, it kind of parallel opens up the conversation of your reflections on the election and where we go from here. And one of the things that I like that you've done, Bill, and I'm going to have you elaborate, is I've been kind of trying over the past couple of weeks to make this argument that, in terms of figuring the fallout of this, it's all of the above. It is a failure of neoliberalism. It is about economics. It's also absolutely about misogyny, racism, and a fear of an America that looks different and feels different. It's all of these things simultaneously. You kind of spelled that out, and I'm wondering if you can kind of and you also began on an encouraging note. So can you kind of give us your sort of main sweep and takeaways of this election and where we are now?
Well, let me start at the end. I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic because actually we won.
Right.
When you look at the election results, you know, Hillary at this point is 2 million votes ahead and climbing.
Yep.
And it's gotten so bad for Trump that he now issues a statement that that 3 million people, he claims, voted illegally. And supplies no evidence, of course.
Totally unfair.
So he's completely unhinged by what's going on. So
right.
I actually think that the elements of the new majority are clearly emerging, that there were problems in the Clinton campaign. There were big mistakes like not going to Wisconsin. There were things that were out of their control, like the FBI note, which I'm convinced had an impact, because before that note, they were on a roll.
Right.
And that note really jammed them.
Yep.
Even when it came out right before the election that there was nothing. But it didn't matter at that point, because it was one more stain. The election, yes, was about neoliberalism, but what I found most interesting about this was the exit polls in terms of what were the issues of greatest concern for Trump voters. And there were two. And they were economic.
Yep.
Immigration and terrorism. Mm-hmm. And once I saw that, then a lot of other things kind of came together. That what we were witnessing was an election that actually could have gone either way. The election results were so close that it really, you know, it was a toss-up. It could have gone either way. And for that reason, we have to be very careful about how we summarize this and not make too many sweeping conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I would say that this was a white nationalist, right-wing populist uprising, where you had a candidate who tapped into the fears of the future among whites. And he tapped into their fears. Let me tell you something, Michael. There was a letter that a friend of mine sent me from a railroad worker who was writing to his union. And the guy said he had voted for Obama in the past. He was voting for Trump. Mm-hmm. That he was voting for Trump because he was voting for his son and his son's future. And I found that actually phenomenal, because basically what this guy was saying was that despite the fact that Trump ran the most misogynist, racist, xenophobic campaign since George Wallace, mm-hmm. that all could be excused because somehow he was better for this guy's son than Hillary. And I think this sort of fear of the future, fear of collapse, fear of the changing demographics became a rallying cry for Trump. Because certain things just don't make any sense. It's like Trump calling Hillary crooked and always crooked Hillary. Mm-hmm. Look at this guy. Look at what he's doing now. Look at what he was doing before. Look at what happened with Trump University. Look at these issues about possible ties with the five families. Look at these things. And this information was out there. And it wasn't like it was a secret. But despite that, and despite this, despite the racism, sexism, et cetera, people voted for him. And my conclusion was that a significant part of his base was deplorable. They are people that voted for him precisely because of the misogyny, mm-hmm. precisely because of the racism. One of the things in terms of gender, misogyny, which is I find very troubling, is when women who voted for Trump were asked about his misogyny, they skipped around that. Mm-hmm. And they talked about their anger or their hatred of Hillary Clinton. But think about it for a second. How many of them were ever able to pin down why they hated Hillary? They mm-hmm. couldn't. I mean, I listened to countless, and they couldn't. And I think that's where you're talking about internalized oppression that exists.
Mm-hmm. Do you... You know, I don't disagree with that in the sense that I think, and as I said, I guess this is also just reflects my usual way of thinking in a way for good and for ill, which is that I'm a, mm-hmm. you know, I'm a synthesizer and I'm sort of looking at as many variables as possible. Do you think though, and because one of the things that's interested me and one of the, I think in some ways the mistakes that have been made in the fallout of this is I think to a certain extent, there has been too much attention paid to the Trump voter in general. I think that there might be a small percentage of people who voted for Obama, and maybe they could migrate back with an economic message. But I think overall, it's not only is it deplorable. I think also overall, it's you know, and I'm trying to make a little bit of a distinction here. It's Republicans. Republicans yeah. voted for the nominee in a That's very right. typical way. What That's right. strikes me and where the neoliberalism piece comes in, and I talked about this last week, you know, the New York Times went to Milwaukee and they spoke to several African-American voters, and granted, you know, it's totally qualitative, but several of the voters they talked to didn't vote. And it was a combination of absolutely voter suppression played a real role because it made the process much more difficult. And that's another thing that we have to obviously we're going to see a lot of that under this administration. And then, you know, but number two, there was just this sort of sense of like, I like the symbolism of Obama. That was great. The economy is terrible. No one's delivering. It's not worth it. And right. it does seem to me that at least, you know, and this is another maybe questionable, well, I'll just make the analogy. When we talk about terrorism in the Middle East as an example, there's always been the argument that, of course, there are some people and some groups that maybe have an innate fanatic ideology, and that's just what they're going to do, even in very favorable conditions. But the counterpoint, and that's true, there is ideology. But the counterpoint is that toxic ideologies are more susceptible when the immune system is bad.
That's
and
right.
So that's, I guess that's where I'm wondering, does the neoliberal piece come in there? That in general, if things are actually working better, is the type of, you know, beyond, I think, what could be 35, 40% of the electorate, which really are voting on white nationalism, because I do think fundamentally the party of republicanism is a white identity party, but that we make ourselves susceptible to it to some degree by doing nothing or so little on economics, poverty, and neoliberalism.
Yeah, well, I think that there's a couple of points here. So yeah. It's interesting the way you frame that, because that's also the way that I frame it. I say that right-wing populism is the herpes of capitalism. that when capitalism as a system weakens, the virus emerges in all of its forms.
Right.
And that is what we've seen time and again in U.S. history, that when the system is weakened, usually by economic crises or something else, that's when this virus really becomes prevalent. So I think that you're absolutely right. I think that the neoliberal globalization has shaken people in so many ways, but it's not limited to what Trump was talking about with trade agreements. It's also about the way automation has been used.
Yes.
It's also about privatization, casualization, anti-unionism. It's all of these things together that have destabilized people's existence and the sense that things are out of control. And then you add on to that an environmental crisis, and people feel like, my God, I don't understand it anymore. Please take us back to the era of the Donna Reed Show. and so thus enters, from stage right, Donald Trump. So I think that's true. But to go back to the first point that you were raising, I think that the interviews that the Times conducted demonstrated that Hillary was not the candidate to lead an anti-corporate populist movement, even though she's gotten more votes than Trump.
Right.
She was not the person. That part of what happened was a failure to more fully mobilize the base. I think that there was some level of people feeling that she was going to win. There was no real need to vote. And just think about what the opinion polls have been saying, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, if I don't feel strongly about her and she's going to win anyway, then what the hell? You know, I can go to a movie for the day, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that was an element. I think that there was also an element of people that were angry with the policies under Bill Clinton, for which they were holding her responsible. I think that that was another factor. I think that there was anger about what happened with the Sanders campaign,
mm-hmm.
And you know, issues about the Democratic National Committee. So there were a number of factors that undermined this. No doubt, the issue of neoliberalism, just to go full circle, is a neoliberal globalization is something that any kind of social movement going forward is going to have to address, not primarily in order to win the Trump voter. Because, see, I'd go further than you. I'd say that, you know, when I look at the vote was actually about 25% of the eligible voters in this country voted for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that kind of core of very reactionary voters is pretty consistent.
Right.
So, again, not to just create lemonade out of lemons, but I think we have to understand 75% of the potential voters voted against Trump or didn't vote. And so it's the people that didn't vote that were eligible that we have to really concentrate on. And there needs to be a message that resonates with them, a message of hope. And I think, unfortunately, the Clinton campaign, although Hope was central to how she presented things at the Democratic convention, the campaign focused much too much on how evil and erratic Trump was, as opposed to what it was that she was proposing for the future.
Right, right. We've actually said a lot in some ways to just, and it's funny because some of the pieces that have come out recently saying that how Berlusconi was contained in Italy was by just starting to treat him like another, you know, bad right-wing politician instead of all this kind of added drama, even if it's warranted. Before we close this conversation, Bill, though, you ended by saying that you feel optimism because clearly, at least demographically, and I think that liberals and Democrats and even leftists to some degree need to train themselves to stop having so much faith in demographics,
right,
you know, leading to good things. But at the same time, it is there. What, from that place of grounded optimism, what do you see next in terms of the, you know, the smart way to go or the most encouraging signs that you're seeing for how we kind of mobilize over the next several years? Because hopefully this isn't just, you know, play defense against this horrific agenda, but maybe it can be led to 4 years out, potentially, you know, finally this sort of long delayed progressive promise.
You know, one of the reasons that we should not look at this as just the pendulum swinging one way and it eventually it will swing another is what happened in 92 with the election of Bill Clinton, that people had been so sick of 8 years of Reagan followed by 4 years of Bush that they saw in Bill Clinton someone who was going to take us out of this, and they did not look at actually what Clinton's politics were as the founder of the Democratic Leadership Council and his embrace of neoliberal economics, et cetera. So we have to be very clear that this is a time to begin projecting an alternative agenda, an alternative on economics, on politics, et cetera. I'm optimistic because I see the kind of currents that emerged in Madison in 2011, Occupy, Black Lives Matter, immigrant rights, the environmental movement. There's an immense amount out there that's churning. And then you add on to that the fact that Clinton got the majority of the votes. So I feel like there are grounds to be optimistic. At the same time, we should not be fall into self-deception. We have been defeated. This may sound paradoxical, but we have suffered a strategic defeat.
Yes.
This is not just a temporary bruising. This is a strategic defeat. And when you suffer a strategic defeat, you have to reevaluate your entire strategy. You have to rethink organization. You've got to think and better understand the strategy of the other side. And that's what needs to happen right now. I know in some quarters, that's precisely what's happening now. And that's the direction that we have to go, because this really is a long-distance run. We have been defeated, yes. So now we've got to figure out, on a state-by-state basis, how we build the collection of forces, bring them together, that actually can win power, and not sit back and think, all right, in 4 years we'll run someone better than Clinton.
Oh, no.
No, you know, it's like we can't do that. And we also have to make sure that in the midterm elections, there's a major mobilization, because there'll be a lot of Democratic senators up for re-election. There'll be tremendous opportunities, and there'll also be tremendous dangers.
Well, Bill Fletcher Jr., I learned so much from talking with you. I really, really appreciate your time, and I hope to do it again soon. Thanks so much.
Always. Thank you. My pleasure.
All right. Be well.
Take care.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Okay, everybody. We're going to get to the fun half. The IMs are open. I'll get on the phones in just a minute. New Two Dope Boys dropping tomorrow with Wozni Lambre, along with Phil McKenzie and I. What were we talking about? Do you remember? You haven't edited it yet. I know that we did a bit where, because we were talking about the restaurant that booked those neo-Nazi troglodytes.
That accidentally had a Nazi party.
And then they were like, oh, our bad. We'll donate the proceeds to the Anti-Defamation League. We actually kind of went easy on the restaurant and the brand F up because I don't think there was really a way to know what was going on.
They probably get places like the National Policy Institute.
Yeah, they probably get a lot of boring policy names for reservations a lot. But, and then Waz said, well, if my grandmother owned a restaurant, she's Haitian, she'd book to anybody. And so we did a bit where Waz impersonated his grandmother, and I called with increasingly horrific bookings from like neo-Nazis to NAMBLA, and he's just like, very good, food, very good. We talked about a lot of other actually really important things. We talked about cities in the age of Trump, cities as sites of resistance, but also sites of their own systemic inequalities in housing, healthcare, and race, how that relates to business. We talked more about the fallout of New Balance endorsing Trump. More and more people getting onto Dope Boys. Subscribe if you haven't already. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. Supporting independent media is really one of the most important things you can do right now. You know that the mainstream press is going to be obsequious to Donald Trump, as they always are to power. And as Bill Fletcher said, this was a strategic defeat. It's an incredibly dangerous time, and it's incredibly important that the ideas, the conversations, the points of resistance, the points of ridicule, the points of satire are empowered, and you allow us to do that. Become a member of the Majority Report today. Follow me on Twitter, actually, @_MichaelBrooks. I will have my own website coming up soon, just FYI. What else is there for people to do? Oh, Majority Report kickback. If you're going to use it, use our Jet and Amazon links. Write us a review on iTunes. Write 2 Dope Boys in a podcast review on iTunes. I think we're at, how many are we at? We're like 127 now. The Majority Report, I think, is in like the mid, like 500 or something. But we need to get up there to the Marc Maron level. 2 Dope Boys needs to get to the Majority Report level, and the Majority Report needs to get to the Marc Maron level. 646-257-3520. No, it's not right. I'm forgetting the number. I'm having a total brain freeze. I apologize because of my cold. Let me see if I... Well, you know what? I don't need
Isn't
to
it 646-257-3920?
It's 3920, yeah. I am sorry, everybody. Thanks for your compassion. All right, everybody. We will see you in the fun half.